Bible reading today is taken from the second half of the Bible, the New Testament. The first book of the New Testament is Matthew, and we're going to read in Matthew chapter 20 at verse 17 today. Matthew chapter 20 at verse 17. If you have one of our green church Bibles, you'll find this on page 988. Matthew chapter 20 at verse 17. It might be helpful, actually, if I read verse 16 as well. Verse 16, for the second time in a couple of chapters, Jesus came out with these words, "So the last will be first, and the first will be last." Now, Jesus was going up to Jerusalem. On the way, he took the 12 aside and said to them, "We're going up to Jerusalem, and the Son of Man will be delivered over to the chief priests and teachers of the law. They will condemn him to death, and will hand him over to the Gentiles to be mocked and flogged and crucified. On the third day, he will be raised to life." Then the mother of Zebedee's sons came to Jesus with her sons and, kneeling down, asked a favor of him. "What is it you want?" he asked. She said, "Grant that one of these two sons of mine may sit at your right and the other at your left in your kingdom." "You don't know what you're asking," Jesus said to them. "Can you drink the cup I am going to drink?" "We can," they answered. Jesus said to them, "You will indeed drink from my cup, but to sit at my right or left is not for me to grant. These places belong to those for whom they have been prepared by my Father." When the 10 heard about this, they were indignant with the two brothers. Jesus called them together and said, "You know that the rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and that high officials exercise authority over them. Not so with you. Instead, whoever wants to be great among you must be your servant, and whoever wants to be first must be your slave, just as the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve, and to give his life as a ransom for many." As Jesus and his disciples were leaving Jericho, a large crowd followed him. Two blind men were sitting by the roadside, and when they heard that Jesus was going by, they shouted, "Lord, Son of David, have mercy on us." The crowd rebuked them and told them to be quiet. But they shouted all the louder, "Lord, Son of David, have mercy on us." Jesus stopped and called them. "What do you want me to do for you?" he asked. "Lord," they answered, "we want our sight." Jesus had compassion on them and touched their eyes. Immediately they received their sight and followed him. Matthew 20 is where we've reached in our study of this gospel. And the next section that we're going to be thinking of is the second half of this chapter, as we learn what Jesus has to say to us about our own individual lives and our life together as a congregation. Well, in recent days, you'll have heard much about Tyson Fury. You will have heard much about his remarkable comeback on a boxing sense. The boxing commentators have used a word on a number of different occasions about Tyson Fury, that he has redeemed himself, that he has clawed himself back from the mess he put himself into. The darkness of despair that he found himself in, he has redeemed himself, he's clawed his way back, he has reclaimed that boxing crown that was rightfully his, and he has accomplished a great work, and it is a work that they've called, they entitle, a work of redemption. That whole notion of redemption isn't just something that's trotted out for sporting events. It's something that finds its way into certain songs. One of the most famous songs of all time is Bob Marley's Redemption Song. That was released 40 years ago this year. And there's some kind of re-release that's going on with that song that's going to happen in the next number of months. And this Redemption Song is talking about securing freedom, except it's a different type of freedom. It's a freedom from our mind, and it's a freedom from everything that may oppress us. And so it might be words in a song, it might be words in a script, it might be scenes from a movie, but the whole notion of redemption, or been ransomed and being paid to secure some kind of freedom, that is something that is not that uncommon for us. Might not necessarily be a word that's used every day in our language, but it is something that is, as a concept, something that we encounter in different arenas. As we begin thinking of what ransomed means from how Jesus speaks of it today, of what redemption means in the eyes of Jesus, we realize that we are dealing in a different order of things. Because where the words of a story or of a song or of a movie scene may speak of somebody doing something to redeem themselves, when the Bible speaks about redemption and a ransom being paid to set us free, it's talking about somebody doing that for us rather than us waking up one day and deciding things are going to be different. It's a work that's done for us, not a work that we do ourselves. And that's the great difference between the use of the term here in Matthew chapter 20 and the use of the term in our society at large. And so this morning we're going to try and uncover what Jesus says about this whole area of being ransomed, of being redeemed, of being purchased, being set free, so that we might be able to ask ourselves, have I been set free? Have I been purchased? Have I been ransomed? Am I now free this morning? Ask yourself that as we work through this section. Well, in the immediately preceding sections, Jesus has delivered his revolutionary message. He has been dealing with a total reversal, as he tries to teach his disciples, a total reversal as to what they and the world around them would think is important, as opposed to what Jesus thinks is important himself. Whether it was this young, rich, influential, religious guy who looked on the outside to have everything sorted, his life sorted, his relationship with God sorted, Jesus diagnoses this guy as being somebody who's lost. The disciples are stunned. Well, if he's lost, what about the rest of us? Jesus moves into the next section, and he makes it clear there that length of service following the Master does not give us a disproportionate influence over the Master, but that rather whether we have been saved at the 11th hour or whether we've borne the heat and burden of the day following our Master for decades, it's all the same grace from a generous God that has enabled us to live. And so Jesus summarized this reversal as far as this world is concerned. The first will be last, and the last will be first. And then it moves into this next environment here where Jesus speaks about greatness. And Jesus speaks about significance. And he does so in a way that again reverses the standards of this world. Well, what's the context? Context maybe starts off in your own house. Picture yourself in either maybe your own house or some other house, and there's a conversation taking place, and you know that type of individual that always has to have the conversation revolving around themselves. You've come across people like that? I'm sure you have. And in the room, you've got other people for whom their life is in crisis at that point. There's real severe issues going on. But the self-obsessed individual is just droning on and on and on about his or her trivial by comparison issues to the bigger issues that are ongoing. If you find yourself recently in that situation, well, remind yourself that Jesus also knows what it's like to be in that situation. This is one of them. Verse 17 tells us that Jesus has been telling his disciples what's going to happen. There's an increasing strain on Jesus. He's told them before they're heading for Jerusalem, but now as they carry on this way up to Jerusalem, Mark's gospel record of this tells us that Jesus was out in front, ahead of the rest of the disciples, and that there was something about that scene that left them amazed and also afraid as they read into the tone of what was happening at this point. Jesus makes it clear for them that when he reaches Jerusalem, that he's going to face the ultimate sacrifice, as it were. He's going to endure the ultimate suffering The ultimate rejection from his own people, the ultimate suffering at the hands of the Gentiles who oppress his own people, and that this is his mission. And there's an increasing sense of Jesus' knowledge about what's going to take place as he moves towards Jerusalem. And so Matthew here notes for us in verse 19 the reference to crucifixion. And crucifixion, that's to be reserved for the worst of the worst. But Jesus tells his disciples here, listen, I'm going to be handed over, mocked, flogged, and crucified. And on the third day, I'm going to be raised to life. And so when Jesus has spoken of this issue, we would be thinking, well, the obvious reaction of the disciples will be, well, how can we support you? If this is the direction you're heading in, if this is a difficulty that you're living with, how can we help you? What can we do? But that's not what's on their mind, because what's on their mind is the trivial by comparison as they come wanting to have a position of prominence in his kingdom. And this time the request for greatness coming from James and John comes through their mother, Salome. If it is Salome, which we think it is, then that would be Mary, the mother of Jesus' sister. So here's Salome, effectively an aunt, coming, and she's kneeling down reverently before Jesus, and she's asking that her sons may have these positions on either side, positions of real prominence, pointing to their greatness within his kingdom that is going to come. When the others hear about this, it's as if a raw nerve has been jabbed, and they're furious. Verse 24, they're indignant. They're raging, in other words, because they too have this desire to have these positions of prominence, to be known for their greatness and their significance. And the fact James and John got in there first has irked them. And so into that context, Jesus speaks about what greatness is. And it's not about being served, it's about serving. It's not about lording it over others, it's about caring and dealing with others. And to almost reinforce this, he directs them to himself and to his own mission. And that's why we have the words here in verse 26 and to 28. Not so with you. Instead, whoever wants to become great among you must be your servant. Whoever wants to be first must be your slave. Why? Just as the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve, and to give his life as a ransom for many. Let's dig a little deeper into this and notice, first of all, that this is the King who serves. Those of you who are history buffs in here and know about the various different monarchs in the UK going back through history might remember about Henry VI. We're not talking about the 8th and the guy who kept changing his wife. We're talking about Henry VI. What was he known for? Well, he was known as somebody who wasn't a particularly great king. Why? Because he was too nice. He was known as the nice king. He was known as the guy who was always really pleasant to his subjects. And so in the cut-and-thrust environment of the world in which he lived, he wasn't regarded very highly. And in fact, his reign didn't last long and it didn't end well. Because surely, if leading is going to be important, then strength of character needs to be present. Determination needs to be present. A degree maybe of cunning, a degree maybe of charm. All these things surely need to be there if somebody's going to be the leader. Well, Jesus tells us something very different. Because Jesus' idea of leading as the king is as one who serves. We have in his answer of verse 28, two tributaries, as it were, of the Old Testament feeding into the river of the New Testament. Whenever we encounter that phrase, the Son of Man, it points back to the Old Testament, to the prophecies of Daniel, for instance, where the Son of Man is one who had a position of real authority, one who had a position of glory, one who was deserving of honor and adulation. And so the Son of Man, just as the Son of Man, as Jesus says it, points back to this notion of one who was glorious, who was awesome. But the other Old Testament tribute takes us from Isaiah chapter 53, when it talks, among other places, of the servant of God, who will ultimately suffer. And so you've got these two tributaries meeting together. You've got the glorious Son of Man, and you have this suffering servant sent from God. And so glory and suffering are being linked in the life and in the mission of Jesus Christ. It's not that glory and suffering are somehow opposite parts of a magnet that would just repel each other. No, in the New Testament teaching, glory and suffering are linked in the life and ministry of Jesus Christ. And you think, but why would someone so glorious end up suffering? Why would someone so true and so just and so compassionate, so caring, why would someone like that end up suffering? It just doesn't make much sense. It just doesn't seem right. And yet, the passage tells us, it is right. It's always been right. It's been right before this world even existed, that the glory of God and suffering would be mixed together in order to set people like you and me free. Well, where is this suffering? It's in two places in this passage. First of all, it's in the reference to the cup. James and John, through Salome, want greatness. Jesus says, verse 22, listen, you really don't know what you're asking for. Can you drink the same cup I'm going to drink with? And they unthinkingly answered, yes, we can. Now, this cup is something we thought of a few weeks back in an evening service. This cup is a symbolic reference to all that was involved in facing a holy God in dealing with sin. And for Jesus, this cup came into clearer focus in Gethsemane. And when it did, it almost crushed him emotionally and physically. It left him in a spiritual condition where he's asking, is there any other way other than this? And he's reconciled to the fact that God's will needs to be done. But this cup is a symbol, as it were, of all of the suffering that's going to result as facing the justice of a holy God against sin. And for Jesus, it's all that's involved in Gethsemane, all that's involved in Calvary, all that's involved in between these two places, it's all wrapped up in this cup. James and John, can you drink the cup I'm going to drink with? Yes, we can. No, you can't. Because in Gethsemane, when this cup will come into view, you'll just fall asleep. And at Calvary, when this cup is needing to be drunk, you're going to abandon. Suffering will come, James and John. Acts chapter 12 tells us about James being the first one of the apostles to lose his life for his faith. We know that John was exiled for his faith. Suffering did come, but drinking that cup, that's a very specific cup that only one who was sinless and pure could drink. Only Jesus could drink it. And so this cup was a cup that Jesus alone could take, and it was a cup that was involving suffering. But why? Why does he have to suffer? Because his suffering, giving his life, is the only way that the ransom can be paid. Because Jesus doesn't talk about a ransom being paid by coins. It's not that he's going to send Peter and maybe all the apostles out to go fishing this time, and in the mouth of all the fish that they may catch will be these drachma coins that'll pay whatever debt needs to be paid. No. The only way this ransom can be paid is if his life is given. So I don't know what comes to mind your mind when you think of ransoms. I don't know, do you think of films like the one Mel Gibson was in? I don't know, do you think of some of the famous people who've been kidnapped and held at ransom, whether it's Frank Sinatra's son back in the 60s, or whether we're thinking of some of the wealthy businessmen who've been kidnapped and ransom notes have been demanded, have been given so that money would be demanded. I don't know what comes into your head when you think of the word ransom. But there's certain components to it. Ransom implies captivity. People are being held against their will. A ransom price being set means that the only way for those who are held captive to be set free is if something is handed over. And these elements need to be present for a ransom, for a redemption to actually take place. So what is it that the people are in captive to that Jesus says they need to be set free from? Well, the Old Testament gives us a number of illustrations of ransoms being paid for to buy people out of debt or out of captivity or slavery or exile or any of these things. But that's not what's been spoken of here. Because if you take a step back and you zoom out slightly from the teaching of the Bible, you realize that the captivity that Jesus will secure freedom from is not a physical captivity. It is a spiritual captivity. It is a spiritual captivity because every single person who has ever lived has been born with that within that whole area of sin within us that's been passed down through every generation from the beginning of this world. That original sin, that means we don't get taught to lie or to steal or to grab or to manipulate or any of these things because it's within us. That is added to as the years go by the things we do and by the things we say and the things that we think, or the things that we should say or should do or should think but don't. It's added to that whole problem, that whole growing list of things. It's added to as we sin against God. What is that? We are rejecting and ignoring God in the world He created, not being or doing what He commands in His laws. And so all of this is added onto this pile that each one of us has against our name. And each one of us is trapped with this sin that is within us, that is around us, that is from us, that is gravitating towards us. All these different ways in which you try and describe how we are in many ways suffocated spiritually by sin. Suffocated to the extent that spiritual life by nature is non-existent. And in that spiritual bondage, in that spiritual prison, we are trapped, unable to set ourselves free from what sin has done. We can't free ourselves merely on the horizontal level, and we cannot certainly not free ourselves in the vertical level before God. We are trapped. And the only way out of that captivity to the power and presence of sin in our lives is for a price to be paid. And that price is found in Jesus Christ's life. He dies so that we may live. He takes our sin so that we might walk free from the curse and penalty of sin. His life alone is the payment that can secure our release. Think of it in another way. We are like people needing rescue. We are on a plane that is being hijacked. And the plane has not yet crashed, but it will do unless there is some payment to secure our freedom. Spiritually speaking, every single one of us, from the youngest in here to the eldest, are in this spiritual bondage, captivity, prison, whatever you want to describe it as, and we need to be set free. The King who has come is the one who's willing to set us free. He's willing to pay the price. The price will be His life. The Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and to give His life. So on the cross, there's a transaction, a great exchange taking place where His life is being given to secure your life A life lived to the full, an eternal life with Jesus, began now and continuing into eternity. And it is a cost that Jesus was willing to bear. It's the cost not simply of the crucifixion, it's the cost of his coming into this world in the first place. It's the cost of him facing the limitations of being in a broken environment. It's the cost of being despised and rejected. It's the cost of everything that Jesus had to go through from the moment of his birth to the moment of his ascension back into heaven. That was the cost. Because sin could not be paid for in any other way. Obviously, we don't necessarily like talking about the word sin, our generation as a whole. But sin is so serious that there is no other way for it to be dealt with other than through the death of Jesus Christ. And so you see, well, how is Jesus coping with this whole prospect? Surely Jesus must be at some stage rebelling. If he's going to face this, this is grim. These words also tell us that there's still that sense of closeness with his Father. He knows that he's going to be betrayed, he's going to be delivered, he's going to be condemned, he's going to be flogged, he's going to be mocked and crucified. But he still says to James and John, listen, these places have been prepared for by my Father. In other words, he's still got this sense of his Father being near to him, being with him, being part of this plan to prosper the people of God. He's not rebelling against the Father and this plan that's going to involve him having to go through all these things. He's still looking to his Father, as he would willingly become the substitute for God's people. I suppose in many ways, being a substitute's not a great thing, is it? I mean, when you're involved in team sports, you want to be part of the starting 11 or starting 15. If you're a substitute, you're like, well, that's just not great. You know you're maybe not necessarily first choice. Or if you have been first choice and you have started the game and then you're subbed off, unless you're injured, then you know it's not really a good thing either, is it? Because either being a sub or being subbed is something that kind of undermines maybe what we think of ourselves. Maybe we think we're better than that of ourselves. Well, substitution in a spiritual sense is even more unpleasant in one way, because it goes against every pride-filled motive that we have. Because substitution in a spiritual sense tells us we cannot save ourselves. Benefiting from this substitution, this great exchange, his life for our life, means it's something done for us, not by us. I mean, we're more comfortable, are we not, thinking about Jesus being our example? Well, he's our example, and we'll try and follow that example. We'll do this and we'll do that. But that's not how freedom is secured, by following Jesus as an example. We need to have Jesus set us free from sin by his substitution. And we have to swallow our pride and realize that it's only through his work on our behalf that freedom is possible today. So this is a king. He's a glorious king. He's an almighty king. He's a king of limitless power and authority. And yet this king has come to serve. And so if the king has come to serve, the king's subjects come to serve too. And that's our second point today. The king's subjects who are there to serve. So we think, the disciples, in many ways, they're a bit of a conundrum, aren't they? Because they know Jesus is going to face all these things, these negative things, and yet they don't abandon him. And we sometimes forget that. They don't abandon him. They know he's going to encounter real difficulties, but they're not washing their hands of Jesus. They're there. They're with him. And even although it looks, to all intents and purposes, the most bizarre notion imaginable, that a kingdom is somehow going to come through Jesus and this group of individuals that are following him, these disciples are convinced his kingdom is going to come. And in that kingdom, there's going to be places of honor, and that's what they're wanting. And so they've got this mix, as it were, this mix of faith with that kind of selfish trait that's still there, with that self-promotion. Because it's almost as if they're making Jesus's promotion, they're wanting this because they know it's going to have a real impact upon themselves. And it does tell us something about the complexity of human nature, doesn't it? Because the more we understand of what we're like, the more we realize we can be such contradictions. Because we can have people who have a high view of Jesus coexisting with an even higher view of ourselves. And you think, how does that work? And yet it's possible. We can be people who have great faith, and we can be people at the same time of great ignorance. How is that possible? It's part of the complexity of how we are as human beings. And so if we're thinking within that complexity of how we can be, if we're thinking of the king's subjects who serve, there's three traits within these subjects of the serving king. There's these traits that will be evidenced with all of God's people, with all of the subjects. What are these traits? Well, trait number one is that there's a grateful acceptance and rest in the substitutionary work of Jesus. There is a grateful acceptance for and rest in the substitutionary work of Jesus, where he paid the price to set us free. Back at the start, mentioned Tyson Fury. Mentioned how Tyson Fury, they speak about him. He has redeemed himself from the mess he got himself into. He's redeemed himself from that mess. He's got himself out of that mess. He's got life back on track, future back on track. He's got that freedom again because of what he's done. Now, interestingly, Tyson Fury would probably say something very different. If you've heard many of the interviews with Tyson Fury, he's very quick to talk about the Lord Jesus Christ as his hope. But the commentators talk about Fury and what he has done to haul himself out of that mess. Bob Marley will tell us about, in the song, about all that we can do in our minds to haul ourselves out of everything that's trapping us. But this is the difference. The hallmark of the king's servants who in turn serve are those who are grateful for and rest in the substitutionary work of Jesus, his ransom on our behalf. He paid the price, we swallow our pride, and we gratefully receive the gift of life that he offers us. Today, some of you need to swallow your pride because you cannot set yourself free from the bondage and captivity of sin. There is a gift that's on offer. A gift that has cost the highest, costliest transaction in the history of this universe. A gift that Jesus was willing to pay the cost of to set you free. But you cannot know that freedom if your pride thinks that you're somehow working towards it. It can't be done. First hallmark is that we are grateful for and rest in the substitutionary work of Jesus. The second hallmark is that what we have, whether it's our time, whether it's our gifts, whether it's our resources, what we have is used not for our own glory, but for his. And you say, well, that's a bit obvious, isn't it? Let me take you back to the contradiction of the human heart. The more we know of the human heart, the more we know how contradictory it can be. And when we're talking here about whatever we have, our gifts, our time, our resources, whatever it is, that's for his glory and not ours, what we are saying is that we are alert to the potential that the human heart has, even in those who have been redeemed, who've been ransomed, who've been set free, the potential within our redeemed heart to be seen. The potential in our redeemed heart to want to be praised, to be thanked, to be seen as indispensable. But all of these things point the glory to ourselves rather than to God. If there's one thing that's going to inhibit greatness, it is when the glory that is due to Jesus Christ is given to another, or even worse, to ourselves. And so the second hallmark of the king's subjects who serve is that whatever we have and whatever we do, it is for his glory and not ours. And the third hallmark is that hallmark of self-sacrifice as opposed to self-service. James and John, through their mother, it's self-service. And Jesus, through his life, his ministry, his death, resurrection, it's self-sacrifice. And the people of God will have that self-sacrificial trait. And at times it's more visible than others in individuals. And if we're honest, there's times where it's more visible in ourselves than at other occasions. But nonetheless, when confronted with the king who serves, the king's subjects are those who will serve self-sacrificially. Jesus gives us examples. At the end of this chapter, you've got two people there who can offer Jesus nothing. They are beggars, nothing to offer him whatsoever, and yet he comes to them and he serves them, knowing he's going to get nothing in return. Or you think of Jesus in that most unsettling yet spectacular of chapters, where I think it's John 13, and he goes down on his knees and he performs the worst job in society, wiping the muck off the feet of his disciples. There you have a king who is serving, showing his servants how to serve. And so the first will be last and the last will be first. Because greatness is not in lording it over people, it's in serving. And so it's all connected to this whole notion of ransom. There has been a price paid. The question is, are we still going to be rejecting that price? Are we still going to be turning our back on that Savior who has willingly gone to such lengths to secure your freedom? Don't reject any longer the offer of life, forgiveness, and freedom. Ransom price paid. It's for you in Jesus Christ.